The Guardian.
Foreign aid budgets are declining, and the role big philanthropy can play in filling the gaps in international development is increasingly in the spotlight. In recent decades, we've seen the emergence of a new generation of giant non-profit foundations. The Ford Foundation and the J. Paul Getty Trust are two of the largest of these, and topping the list is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has focused on health and poverty in the developing world. It has an endowment of almost $40 billion. In 2011, it spent almost $2 billion on global health efforts. That's more than the bilateral aid budgets for health spending in Japan, Germany, France, or the UK. But in the Global South, suspicions remain about the size and motives of these huge organisations. I'm Hugh Muir, and in this month's Global Development Podcast, we'll explore where philanthropy is heading, what challenges does it face, and how could it be done better? Joining me in the studio is Lauren Traceman from the Indigo Trust, one of the charitable trusts held by the Sainsbury family, which founded one of the UK's largest supermarket chains. Down the line from Tunis is Priti Sinha from the African Development Bank. And joining us from California is Jane Wales. She's Chief Executive Officer of the Global Philanthropy Forum, a network of philanthropists working in the developing world. Thank you all for joining us. Jane, let me start with you. Your organisation brings together philanthropists working in development. Why was it necessary to create the Global Philanthropy Forum?
I think the key is that, and I'm sure that my colleagues on the line will agree, that one of the most important aspects of philanthropy is its capacity to take risks. But that means that there are failures along the way. And we believe that if a philanthropist has a setback, they're much more likely to persevere if they have colleagues as well. Secondly, philanthropists want to learn. They always want to learn so they can prove the outcomes they seek. And peer learning is sometimes the most effective way of gaining the knowledge that they find most useful. And then finally, there are opportunities to expand philanthropy, especially in emerging economies. And again, peer networks can make a big difference.
You have that global view. Give us some idea of the scale and the impact of philanthropy right now.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, philanthropy over the years has had remarkable impacts. I think the thing to do is sort of step back and think, you know, a century ago, we didn't have intergovernmental organizations like the World Bank or development agencies like DFID or even a robust civil society like, you know, organizations like CARE and BRAC. So I'd say that over time, philanthropy has built the capacity we need in order to affect change. And now what you're seeing is a new infusion of wealth held by folks that are young, they're at the height of their career, they're problem solvers, and they're willing to be bold. So this is the scale is large, but also the approach is inventive.
Lauren, talking with people who are young and at the height of their careers, tell us about the Indigo Trust and your work with it. It's been described as a new kind of philanthropic trust. What makes your work different from the other big organisations that we hear about?
Sure. I think one of the things that we do that is really different is that we highly prioritise funding local organisations. We provide funding in Africa, and we really believe that the best solutions to Africa's challenges will be devised by Africans themselves. And so we basically try and find young, passionate individuals that have good ideas, and we fund them to enable them essentially to take risks with room for trial and error.
So what are you doing that governments can't? Are you into areas that governments are wary of treading into?
To some extent, I'd say yes, because we are supporting a lot of transparency and accountability initiatives, and this can be politically sensitive. As I think has already been mentioned also, philanthropists have a lot more of an ability to take risks. And another thing I think we can do is take a longer-term view than governments can. Obviously, with political cycles, it can be hard to take a long-term view sometimes. And what philanthropists can actually do is start funding pieces of the jigsaw. We might not be able to do everything straight away, but we can start doing things that move us towards positive change.
Give me an example of something that you've done that's there because you stepped into the breach perhaps when governments didn't want to do that.
Sure. I think one good example of that might be that we're funding a lot of local organisations to work with a UK-based organisation called My Society to basically develop parliamentary monitoring sites that give people information on elected representatives and parliamentary proceedings. And as I said, this in itself won't lead to increased accountability, but it's a necessary precursor to more effective accountability mechanisms and citizen empowerment in country.
OK, well, we'll talk about accountability and transparency a bit later, but Preeti, let me come to you, because we were talking there about philanthropy in Africa. You're there on the ground. Give us an idea of what the landscape is like in terms of philanthropic investment in Africa at the moment.
Okay, so to give context, you know, we are a multilateral bank and we work with loans and grants and in priority areas such as infrastructure. So our interactions with philanthropists is more on, you know, trying to create sustainable development, which means helping them create private sector development with jobs. So we are a bit focused on creation of enterprises. So using kind of philanthropic capital in this new term called philanthrocapitalism to really create entities of the future. So it's not something that you give once and it's over, that it's something that evolves. I think philanthropy in Africa is just beginning. It's taking off and taking off very well. There isn't very clear estimates, but one number puts it at $20 billion US dollars at this time. But that might relate to sort of the tax incentives given to philanthropic organizations in Africa. But there are certainly some individuals that are very prominent right now. And to name a few would be Tony Elmulu of Nigeria, and they are creating foundations and really giving an impetus to local philanthropy here on the ground.
As you're on the ground, we may as well tap your local knowledge. What sort of things are they doing? What sort of areas are they concentrating on?
So these are, again, are the entrepreneurs or the, you know, the African billionaires who are now turning towards this model that was set up, you know, by the Gates and Warren Buffett. So they really want to take their business expertise and use that while giving capital. So, for instance, I know Tony Elmelu runs sort of tutorials on mentoring, you know, on enterprise development and so on. So it's pretty much a form of creating entities that will, again, create jobs.
Jane, let me come back to you. What impact do you see these new philanthropists having in the long term? And do you have a sense of how they differ from country to country? Does the culture make them different in each territory?
Well, let me just add to what Preeti noted, and that is that you're also beginning to see some of these philanthropists in emerging economies like Nigeria partner with colleagues from overseas. So, for example, Alike Dangote of Nigeria as well has partnered with the Gates Foundation in the effort to eradicate polio. I think that one of the key differences between philanthropy in emerging economies and the more traditional philanthropy is just what Preeti noted, and that is a willingness and an ease with which they kind of cross sectors. So they're very comfortable leveraging markets. They're very comfortable thinking in terms of building social enterprises, you know, small companies that can create goods and services and income opportunities for the poor. By and large, they're younger, they're bolder, they're more diverse, they're close to the problem, they understand the context, and they're far enough from traditional institutions to find entirely new ways of doing business, doing philanthropy.
Presumably it's very important that they know the area as well, that they know the territory and have a good idea as to what is needed, and also can maybe see if the money's being well spent.
Yes, absolutely. And at the same time, what they'll do is they'll take a look at evaluation techniques that are developed by organizations like the African Development Bank, like the UNDP, and like foundations elsewhere.
Lauren, talking culturally, what about the UK? You're based in the UK. I know you work all over the world, but are we really into philanthropy here in the UK?
Well, I think it's definitely a smaller industry than it is in the US, for example. And some of that, I think, to some extent relates to our role to government. We have a lot more desire, if you like, for government to provide social services than they do somewhere like the US. But I think something that's important to add to this part of the discussion is that I think philanthrocapitalism is fantastic and it definitely has a role. And we are, to some extent, supporting financially sustainable businesses. But one thing I think we also need to recognise is that there are areas which have experienced market failure. So things like supporting democratic processes, citizen empowerment, these sorts of issues. And so we do need to make sure that philanthropic money also focuses on areas where it might not be realistic to have sustainable businesses.
Preeti, pick up that point. How do you make sure that the money is going into the right areas? Because one can imagine that a rich family or a rich philanthropist just having a particular hobby horse, if you like, having a particular idea of something that they're very interested in, but that might not be the priority.
I think these individuals are pretty grounded. So another example, this year, South African billionaire Patrice Motsepe announced that he would give away half of his fortune to a foundation, and that would improve lives of the poor creating, you know, community-based organizations. So I think they come from very grounded backgrounds, you know, and being in the country and having developed businesses there. And many of them are very big success stories. So, for instance, going back to Tony El-Mulu, he developed the UBA Group, United Bank of Africa, with $5 million to start. So I think they're pretty grounded, and they can keep an eye on what's going on and, you know, hire the right people to help them implement these foundations. And I think they are working on public-private philanthropy. So they are looking at areas where government funds are not sufficient or failing, and then they're trying to fill some gaps. But what we are seeing on the continent, obviously, are the youth is a big issue. So trying to create, again, this structure that will help the youth for the future is important.
Jane, is it easy for individual philanthropists to deal with governments? Are governments geared up to deal with them?
Well, that's a great question, because I mean, in general, I would argue that the answer to the first question is very much yes, that philanthropists have always had the capacity to collaborate with governments. That dates back to the Green Revolution and other large philanthropic enterprises. But now governments are more keenly aware of the opportunity to partner with them. I'd note that there are some experiments on how to, in ways to align the activities of and goals of philanthropy with those of a government. In the case of Liberia, for example, philanthropic leaders like George Soros and Pam Amidio got together and said to themselves, you know, it's not a good use of President Sirleaf's time to be always meeting with us rather than with her constituents, which is where she means to be and wants to be. And so it would be great if we saw the existence of a secretariat within, you know, inside the president's office that look at the development goals of the country, of the president, of the government, and then share those goals with philanthropic leaders and help find ways to coordinate activities. So I think that's a great model. We'd love to see that happen in any other country, particularly one in transition, as was the case of Liberia when this was established.
Okay, clearly important that everyone is singing from the same hymn sheet. Lauren, let me just read a quote to you. The U.S. National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy argues that the public has a legitimate interest in the use of philanthropic resources. Donors receive the privilege of tax deduction for charitable donations and tax exemption on investments. Both self-regulation and government oversight are needed to ensure that philanthropy serves the public good and is not abused for personal or political gain. And that's really important, isn't it? Because even if it's not public money being handed over, there is a public element in terms of the tax breaks there might be. And also it's important that the public know where money is going and know it's going to the right places.
I'd absolutely agree with that. And I think it's not only that we have a duty to be accountable to the public, I also think it's great to build a relationship of trust. And we've actually found that through being open about our work, sharing our successes and failures, we've built trust with our grantees and other stakeholders. So that's been really valuable. I think one thing that's really important to say is that transparency isn't only good for showing others what we're doing. It's really important for us as philanthropists. If we can share our data and share information, then we're effectively able to make our giving more effective. We can ensure that money gets to where it's needed most. We can make more informed choices. We can ensure that there's less leakage and corruption. So I think there's actually great benefit for us in terms of releasing our data. And there are some standards now that are being created, such as the IATI standard, and lots of bilaterals and multilaterals are signing up to this. We've signed up to it and recently Gates Foundation, which we're delighted about. And I think it's really important that other philanthropists are willing to engage in this sort of thing so that we can all make sure that we're making informed choices.
Priti, do you find that philanthropists know about the need to be this transparent? Are they embracing that transparency agenda?
I'm sure they are. For instance, when they work with us, so we as a bank could form trust funds through which you know they could invest for a common purpose. And then we really believe a lot in results and transparency. So, you know, we have public accounts of, let's say, in a four-tier manner. So one is, you know, how is Africa itself developing? And then how does what you contribute help this development? And then how we internally manage our portfolio and the organization. So we certainly subject at least what comes through the bank to such standards. And again, the ones that we deal with are very professional, in our opinion, and definitely into creating sort of public accounting. There are various now institutions such as DFID and Publish What You Fund, etc., which are keeping an eye on such matters. So the rankings become sort of a league table, which organizations are quite keen to do well in.
Okay, well, let's turn to one of the main critiques and perhaps the central critique that people sometimes make about philanthropy, namely that it keeps the existing structure of global inequality in place. Now, of course, Warren Buffett is one of the world's most famous philanthropists, but his son, Peter, has talked about conscience laundering. That's the wealthy feeling better about accumulating more than any one person could possibly need by sprinkling a little around as an act of charity. Isn't the very fact that individuals can be wealthy enough to set up multi-billion dollar foundations part of the problem? Isn't that central to the whole thing? And wouldn't it be better to look at how these rich people actually made their money than to applaud them for how they spend it? Jane, what's your view on that?
Oh, dear. By that standard, John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie would not have been considered legitimate. I'm not sure they were lovely fellows when it came to the making of their money. I think the key is, number one, I think it would be very hard for us to get into the head of individual philanthropists and have a sense of their true motivations. What we can observe, and that's why one of the reasons transparency is such a valuable attribute, is that what we can observe is the impact of their work. Are they making a difference? Are they advancing the public good? Are they being accountable in all their dealings? I would just argue that they're kind of two levels of accountability, one for compliance, but the other for learning and for impact. And I think that needs to be our focus, mainly because we have, frankly, less knowledge of what motivates them.
So to what extent can we be sensitive or even squeamish about where the money comes from?
I think we have to. I mean, I think philanthropy, just like every other sector, requires ethical leadership. And I think there's a direct tie between how ethical you are and what kind of impact you achieve.
Lauren, one of the interesting phenomenon here is that philanthropists are often very keen to make sure, one, that the money is being used with maximum effectiveness, and two, to have an audit of where the money is going. Is there a danger, though, that with those imperatives, they place so much onus on the people who are getting the money that they spend more time logging what they're doing with the money and showing that there is that audit trail than actually doing the work they should be doing?
I think there definitely is a risk of that. And obviously it's a balance to be made, because we do want to make sure that our money is reaching where it's been said that it would. But also there is a risk of becoming overly bureaucratic and spending a lot of time on processes. But we've actually found that there can be a lot of informal monitoring that doesn't take as much paperwork and isn't as cumbersome, especially now with the advent of technology. We follow a lot of our grantees on Facebook and Twitter. We ask for regular testimonies. I go and visit them in the field. And it means that actually we don't ask for too many lengthy reports and summaries. Again, another thing that we can do is that through collaborating with other philanthropists, we can also reduce the burden on grantees, because often we're all asking for the same things again and again and again. Whereas if we comply collectively, then we can actually put less burden on them. And again, IATI can have a role here, because it can mean that people are publishing once rather than having to publish for different funders.
Preeti, in Africa, I imagine the NGOs maybe have less of an infrastructure to be able to deal with that sort of bureaucracy. Isn't that a worry?
I think the emphasis on results is important, and there's increasing sort of voice and accountability from the NGO world. Obviously, this can improve and increase, because I think philanthropy in Africa is just beginning, I would say. So I think we look to the future. Again, we try to do as a development bank as much as we can, having a CSO kind of operation, helping CSOs strengthen, which is civil society organizations, strengthen their voice. But there can still be work done in this area.
Jane, you talked just earlier about almost matchmaking, bringing philanthropists together who might be interested in the same area. Just talk a little about how that works.
Well, I think the key there is with the new folks newly entering philanthropy itself or a given field, often they'll have a sense of what they want to achieve. They might want to help address a specific disease. They might want to help raise the status of women in a part of the world. But they're not sure that they really have a deep understanding of the issue area or a deep understanding of their potential partners with whom they can work. And so when those philanthropists come to us and state that interest, what we do is we don't match them with grantees, because there are lots of folks who can help guide them with that activity. But instead, we match them with philanthropists who themselves have been highly effective in advancing precisely the same goal, so that they learn from each other and they have the capacity to partner with each other if they choose to do so.
And are people like that, people who've been very successful in their own right, are they happy to work in tandem with other people like that? Don't the egos get in the way?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, you know, who is the biggest player in private philanthropy here in the U.S.? It's Bill and Melinda Gates. They had every reason to believe, well, if anybody can go it alone, we can go it alone. They immediately, right out of the gate, started collaborating with others, because the nature of the problems they're trying to solve, you know, outweigh any resources that even the Gates would have. But secondly, they understand that the solutions lie in more than one sector. So that they can leverage governments, if they can leverage the private sector, their impact will be greater. So collaborating with other philanthropists can help them make a difference, as can collaboration across sectors.
Okay. Well, let's each of you do some forecasting for us. I'd like to know from you all what trends you think we're seeing in the sphere of philanthropy. What's likely to happen next? I'll start with you, Lauren.
It's always difficult to predict the future, but one thing I'm definitely hoping that we'll see is an increase in the number of philanthropists within the countries we support. We've spoken a bit about people like Tony Elamelu, and I'm hoping that there'll be an influx of these sorts of people. I think we're also obviously seeing an increase in market-based approaches, and it remains to be seen whether that'll be successful or not, but there's definitely an impetus towards supporting social enterprises as opposed to traditional aid models.
Okay, and Priti, what's the next big thing?
Well, we're still hoping that, you know, the e-philanthropy and the technology can help us get some things rolling further. So, for instance, you know, platforms, Kiva, etc., which can get maybe the African diaspora to invest in SME business development in Africa, that would be very interesting for us. How do we channel diaspora funding as kind of a philanthropy of the masses into SME development? That would be great.
And Jane, what's in your intro? What do you expect to be doing in the first few months of 2014?
Well, I think Lauren already cited the role of big data, and I'd argue that many of the world's problems and many of their solutions will be the result of the aggregate of many individual choices. And now with big data, now with the communications technologies we have, we've got the capacity to, or philanthropy has got the capacity to inform individual choices, and that strikes me as the biggest opportunity ahead.
So that's how the future looks, but that's all we have time for in this month's podcast. My thanks to Jane Wales, Lauren Traceman, and Priti Sinha. The producer was Ian Chambers. If you want more on this or other development matters, you can turn to our website. That's theguardian.com/global-development. I'm Hugh Muir. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.